This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, Tempus Fugit, Time Flies, by Fred Fletcher with Chuck Holmes. Recorded solely for the blind and physically handicapped, with the kind permission of the copyright holder, Fred Fletcher, 1990. Published by Bookcrafters Incorporated, Chelsea, Michigan. Narrated by Ward Zimmerman. This recording is tone indexed. The beginning of each chapter will be indicated by 1 beep, audible when your cassette player is in the fast forward or rewind mode. This book contains 182 pages on 4 sides. From the book jacket, for nearly a generation, first on radio and then on television, Tempus Fugit amused and entertained the people of Raleigh and eastern North Carolina. Now everybody has another opportunity to be amused and entertained by Tempus Fugit, the book. Fred Fletcher, the man behind Tempus Fugit, recounts his experiences in Raleigh as a Southerner in school in Chicago, as a broadcaster, and as a sometimes politician and full-time recreation proponent. When Fred helped put Raleigh's second radio station on the air, despite the fact that there was some doubt that a second radio station was needed, Raleigh was a very different place. There was little traffic and no traffic jams. The Raleigh Caps and the Big Four football teams provided most of the excitement, and the city paid its employees in cash. Fred Fletcher was an active part of Raleigh's growth for more than a half century, and as the fairy tale man, Peter Rabbit, Bozo the Clown, and as the irrepressible Fred Fletcher, he provided everybody with more than a few chuckles along the way. Return with Fred to the days of yesteryear, when the radio was the center of family entertainment and prices were a lot lower than they are today, and you'll probably find that Tempus does indeed fugit, especially when you're having fun. If you remember when an evening's broadcast entertainment might include a walk down Allen's Alley, the top 10 tunes on the hit parade, or learning what the shadow knows, the hot spot was the show for the Hepcats. Loose lips sank ships, and flattening a tin can was striking a blow for our side. The Caps-Red Sox exhibition game was a big draw. Ray Reeve announced sports better than anybody else. The fairy tale man was as much a part of a kid's morning as oatmeal or cornflakes. The Raleigh Christmas Parade brought people to Fayetteville Street from miles around. Gasoline was 18 cents a gallon. Then you'll get more than a few happy remembrances and pleasant chuckles from Tempus Fugit. On the radio, Fred Fletcher learned to talk to that guy just beyond the microphone. In this book, he does the same thing. About the author, people have called Fred Fletcher a lot of things. The North Carolina Association of Broadcasters called him a member of the NCAB Hall of Fame. The News and Observer called him Tar Heel of the Week. The JCs called him Man of the Year. And the National Recreation and Park Association called him an outstanding leader in advancing the recreation, park, and conservation movement when they presented him with the Robert M. Arts Award. Thousands of eastern North Carolinians called him the fairy tale man, and 7 grandchildren call him Papa. In this book, Fred Fletcher proves that everybody was right, and then some. Ancillary note. Between chapters 13 and 14, there is a pictorial section of 63 pictures with captions. The captions will be read. End ancillary note. Table of Contents. Side 1. Acknowledgements. Chapter 1. Not All My Life. Chapter 2. You have to start somewhere. Chapter 3. 3 out of 4 ain't bad. 4. On My Own in Chicago. 5. The Birth of a Station. Sides 1 and 2. 6. He Held the Lantern. Side 2. 7. Tempus Fugits, Every Morning. 8. The Fairy Tale Man. 9. And Back in the Real World. Chapter 10. And Still Tempus Fugits. Chapter 11. The Keeper of the Zoo. 12. Tuning in with Fletcher. Sides 2 and 3. 13. Reaching out. Side 3. Pictorial section. Chapter 14. All the news that fits. Chapter 15. Fred Fletcher, politician. 16. Radio with pictures. 17. And now that you have it, sides 3 and 4. 18. A man of many parts and one park. Side 4. 19. The private life of Fred Fletcher. Chapter 20. The party of the first part loves all the parties of the second part. 21. The last word, I promise. Acknowledgements. A lot has happened in the past 80 years. Unfortunately, I've forgotten much of it, and if it had not been for the help, patience, and endurance of my family and friends, this book would have been much smaller. I would like to officially thank all of those who contributed time and effort for this project. First, thank you, Margie. Not only did Margie help me remember much of what is in here, she lived through most of it with me. And thanks to our children, Kay, Fred Jr., and Bill. They all read the manuscript and made their contributions. And thanks to my friends who put up with odd-hour phone calls with questions like, what was the name of the Ringling Brothers' ringmaster? A partial list of these patient people includes Paul and Camilla Montgomery, Scotty Stevenson, Mike Silver, Virgil and Sarah Duncan, Helen Robinson, Dr. Hugh McManus, Marguerite Reeve, David Witherspoon, George Hall, Paul Hoover, Gene Lutz, Frank Evans, Duma Bledsoe, Jim Daniels, and Jimmy Team. I have certainly left out that many more, and to those I apologize. I hope all of you, after reading this, think it was worth the effort. And to my grandchildren, one of whom wondered if they would be mentioned in the book, hello, Dade, Adam, Christy, Tommy, Caroline, Brad, and Matthew. I hope you'll find some stories in here to tell your children. Chapter 1. Not All My Life. In October of 1982, Wally Ausley stood up and said 4 or 5 minutes' worth of nice things about me, and I was inducted into the North Carolina Association of Broadcasters Hall of Fame. In 1985, again in October, at the National Recreation and Park Association meeting in Dallas, Texas, I was awarded the Robert M. Arts Award for Citizen Volunteer Leadership. They said that the Arts Award was for outstanding leadership and service over many years toward advancing the recreation, park, and conservation movement, not only in his own community and state, but throughout the nation. I was very pleased to receive both of these awards. They were, as I immodestly thought, a wonderful recognition of the efforts that I had put into two of the greater passions of my life, broadcasting and recreation. And it's always nice to have someone stand up in front of a crowd of people and say nice things about you. The thing that bothered me was that they both talked about a lifetime of work or a lifetime of service. It reminded me of the old farmer's reply when the young radio reporter asked him if he had been a farmer all his life. Not yet, the old farmer said. It can make you feel a little uneasy, no matter how great the honor, when people start summing up your life. Even though I have enjoyed somewhat more than my allotted 70, I'm just not ready to be summed up yet. However, my good friend Paul Montgomery reminded me that as he and I and a bunch of other wonderful people tripped through the years, we've been so involved in living our lives that we didn't always appreciate everything that was happening, even when it was happening to us. He was right, as Paul often is, and the more I thought about it, the more worthwhile it seemed to set down some of the things that happened over the last 70-plus years before there's nobody around to remember them anymore. A word of warning, though. This is not a history. If somebody reads this and writes me that something happened in 1944 instead of 1943, I'll probably agree. Because when we talked about some of the really important things that happened to us, 3 or 4 people sometimes came up with 3 or 4 dates. But that doesn't matter. What matters is that it did happen, and, for the most part, we all enjoyed it. Nor is this account unbiased. readers who want an objective view of Raleigh, North Carolina broadcasting, local politics, or any of these other subjects are invited to look at back issues of the News and Observer or the Raleigh Times. Over the years, I've known a lot of people, some of whom I have loved, many that I have liked, and a few I really didn't care for. I've put in as many of the first two categories as my memory and space will allow, and generally ignored those in the third category. Now, if you're still with me, I hope you enjoy this book, especially those of you who show up in it, either by name or as a player in one of the situations. We all shared a great time together. From that comes the title of this book. As you may know or will surely learn, I wasn't much of a student, being much better in extracurricular activities than curricular activities. In fact, the total of my Latin, despite the valiant efforts of Miss Iva Barden of Hugh Morrison High School, is tempus fugit, time flies, and tempus especially fugits when you're having fun. I've gotten a lot of mileage out of those two words of Latin over the years. I did the morning show on WRAL radio for 16 years and called it Tempus Fugit. Then we put it on television. Now, having found it better than the other 16 or 17 names that I came up with for this book, I'm recycling it. Footnote. For those interested in the creative process, other names considered for this book were For the Love of Mike, Fred Fletcher, Local Yokel, Fred, Let Down Your Hair, with apologies to whoever wrote the original. Anybody who has met me over the years will understand the supposed humor of the title. And, of course, The Fairy Tale Man. End footnote, return to text. Probably more use than anybody else got out of Miss Barden's Latin class, unless, of course, they became a doctor. The title is especially applicable since so much of the time that has flown was fun. I never saw a day when I didn't want to go to work. And why not? Over the years, I have been the Fairy Tale Man, the Keeper of the Lost and Found, the Easter Bunny, Bozo the Clown, and a sometimes singer. I have found and stayed married to a wonderful wife, have 3 children and 7 grandchildren, also wonderful, and have enjoyed the company of a number of fine, if slightly unhinged, friends. As the late Harry Golden from Charlotte might have said, "What's not to like?" Well, a few things, but we'll get into those later. Chapter 2, You Have to Start Somewhere. When you set out to write something like this, you find yourself digging into memories that you haven't disturbed in years. In my case, I'm looking at nearly 80 years of memories, some of them surprisingly clear and detailed. It's also surprising how things that seemed important to you when you were 5 or 6 years old still seem important now, even though you wouldn't give it a second thought if it happened today. I remember, for instance, running down the street and into the house in Fuquay Springs to tell Mother that there was an airplane flying over. That memory is still exciting today, even though none of us would even look up at an airplane these days. And I remember the Christmas my brother Frank and I got a note from Santa Claus saying that the Oriole bicycles that we expected were going to be late. But what I remember most was the excitement we felt when we got a message, not from Santa Claus, but from the man who owned the bicycle shop, who had for Fuquay Springs, North Carolina, the unlikely name of Siegfried. He told us that our bicycles were there and we could come and get them. Frank and I ran all the way down to the bicycle shop. We also ran all the way back because neither of us knew how to ride a bicycle. Then there were the Easter Monday celebrations in Fuquay. I don't know why our town picked Easter Monday, but they did it up brown. We had a parade in pennants and balloons. There were clowns and street vendors, and the whole town turned out. The farmers came into Fuquay Springs from miles around. It certainly wasn't as big as the state fair, but when you are very young and very small, everything looks, and is remembered, bigger. There are some other memories of Fuquay, too, some not altogether pleasant. There was the time, for instance, that our father caught Frank and me smoking cigarettes. After checking with the doctor to make sure that he wasn't going to do any permanent damage, he made us smoke the rest of the pack, one right behind the other. The bad news was that we both got very sick. The good news was that his punishment, suited as it was to the crime, cured my yearning for cigarettes for the rest of my life. In all, the memories of being 7 years old in a small farm town in North Carolina are pleasant. When you're that young, you don't worry about the heat of the summer or the cold of the winter. Everything is an adventure. The story, however, doesn't start in Fuquay. In fact, so far as the influences I can remember, it starts a long time before I was born with my grandfather, J. Floyd Fletcher. My grandfather was a circuit preacher in the mountains of North Carolina and Virginia in the days when churches paid their preachers little or nothing. I know, for instance, that one church paid him 65 cents. That's 65 cents for a year's work. Another paid him with an overcoat and a horse. That made no difference to him, though. He served his churches, up to six of them at one time, on foot and on horseback, and from his recollections, he felt privileged to do it. He served in the ministry for 71 years. The Reverend Floyd Fletcher was a totally dedicated man, and I've always hoped that a substantial part of me came from him. In addition to having up to six churches to serve, Grandpa and his wife, Louisa Barker, had 13 children, one of which was A.J. Fletcher, my father. Thus endeth the begats. There has, I suppose, been a raucous strain in our family for some time. It surfaced, for instance, during the courtship of my mother and father. On his brother Arthur's advice, A.J. had gone to Apex to be editor and sole employee of the Apex Journal. After settling in Apex, he began courting Miss Elizabeth Utley. Evidently, the Utleys didn't see A.J., son of a preacher and a young man with small possessions and an arguable future, as a suitable candidate for marriage. Some of them must have expressed their opinions rather forcefully, because A.J. began carrying a .32-caliber pistol even when he taught his Sunday school class at the Baptist Church. Evidently, something changed Mr. and Mrs. Utley's mind, because A.J. and Miss Elizabeth did get engaged, and they did get married, with A.J. still carrying the .32-caliber pistol. The feud between the Utleys and the Fletchers didn't end immediately, however. According to A.J.'s account, his brother, Arthur, made a comment about how noisy some Utley children were at the wedding. Their father overheard the remark and took offense. He and one of his brothers confronted Arthur at the railroad station while he was seeing the newlyweds off. According to A.J., Arthur felled the first Utley with one punch, then waded in on the other one, who decided he didn't really want to fight after all. It was noted that the first Utley was seen at the railroad station the next morning trying to find the gold tooth that Arthur had knocked out. It was not noted that the new groom was involved other than as a reporter, and as that some 50 years after the fact. That's the last recorded incident of the feud between the Utleys and the Fletchers, and evidently at least one Fletcher and one Utley were getting along moderately well, because shortly after the marriage, but well beyond the requisite 9 months, I arrived, the first of the four children to be born to A.J. and Elizabeth Fletcher. I first met this world in the bedroom of Grandma Utley's house, ushered in by Dr. Charlie Wilkerson. It was in that same year, 1910, that Josiah Bailey was running a reform campaign to clean up the Wake County courthouse ring. A.J., as editor of the Journal, jumped into the fray with all of the influence a small-town weekly newspaper could offer. Much of what he wrote was picked up and rerun by the News and Observer, then edited by Josephus Daniels. It was A.J.'s first involvement in politics and, according to his account, the first and last time he was on the same side with the News and Observer. After the campaign, A.J. decided to return to Wake Forest to go to law school, so he, mother, and I moved to Wake Forest. A.J.'s undergraduate study at Wake Forest had an interesting beginning. His brother, Arthur, was already enrolled there and was doing well scholastically and as an orator. When A.J. showed up, Arthur, according to A.J., promised the registrar, Dr. E.W. Sykes, that he would write for A.J.'s transcript. The fact that the transcript never arrived, largely because A.J. did not have a high school diploma, was eventually forgotten or ignored. A.J.'s grades seemed to be evidence enough. When A.J. was licensed to practice law, we all moved to Sparta, North Carolina. Shortly after that, he was offered a job by Congressman Robert L. Daughton as the congressman's private secretary, and we all moved to Washington, all of us, including my brother Frank. I take the preceding on hearsay, because it was not until we moved from Washington to Fuquay Springs that I remember anything of my own life. As I remember it, we settled in rather well in Fuquay Springs. A.J. became active in community affairs, played tennis, and promoted a number of musical affairs, including a fiddler's convention and Chautauquas. The whole family was active in the Baptist Church. A.J. was named Sunday school superintendent and teacher of the men's Bible class. Even my mother, born and raised a Methodist, was involved in the Baptist Church. Mother, as most mothers were in this pre-World War I period, was a housewife. She cooked and cleaned and looked after her growing family. The third son, Floyd, was born, and with three of us, she had a handful. Mother, even though she was focused on home and family, gave me an early and important lesson on negotiation. I can remember running into the house and telling her, "Mama, I want a biscuit." Her reply was always, "But Fred, you don't need a biscuit." It didn't take me long to understand that what I should be saying was, "Mama, I need a biscuit." That, at least, cuts out one level of negotiation. Occasionally, we would return to Apex to visit Grandpa and Grandma Utley. I remember the troop trains that pulled up at the siding along Grandpa's front yard. We would run alongside the trains talking to the soldiers. And it was in Apex that I suffered an early and memorable loss. For months, I had been saving the Octagon soap wrappers as Grandma unwrapped a new bar of soap. Finally, I had saved enough for a genuine birthstone ring. I'm not sure why I wanted a birthstone ring at that age, but I know I wanted it. I saved for it. Then I waited for it. Finally, I got it. And very shortly after that, I dropped it down the well and lost it forever. I'm sure that I've lost much more valuable things in my life, but the birthstone ring is the one I remember. Meanwhile, the Fletcher family with the lawyer father, the pretty, well-bred mother, the three boys, the horse and buggy, and the cow could have become fixtures in Fuquay Springs, and if what I remember of it held true, it would not have been a bad place to grow up and maybe raise a family of my own. But A.J. felt that there was more opportunity in a larger setting. After 6 years of practicing law there, he was earning about $6,000 a year. And that $6,000 was made up of more than 400 fees. So, in 1918, the Fletcher family moved to Raleigh, moving first to a house on South Boylan Avenue, and then to the house I grew up in on Glenwood Avenue. Shortly after we moved to Raleigh, my sister, Betty Lou, was born. After three boys, my mother and father finally had a girl. In Raleigh, we were, at least to my young eyes, moving up in the world. A.J. sold the Ford and bought a Franklin from Ivan Clendenin. He was a part of a larger law firm with offices in the Security Bank building and several names on the door. Frank and I were enrolled at Wiley Elementary School on West Morgan. We all went to church. Mother continued to cook, keep house, and play the piano. A.J., in addition to practicing law, continued to promote musical events. These musical events were no small thing. They included several Atwater Kent winners, nationally known musicians. Two that I remember in particular were Wilbur Evans and Ben DeLoach. In all, living in Raleigh was like living in Fuquay Springs on a slightly larger scale. As I was digging up memories and sorting them out for this chapter, I had a delightful reminder of my elementary school years. I ran into Annie Sue Askew in the drugstore, the first time I had seen her in years. Annie Sue was my fourth grade sweetheart, one of the first of several fine women who expressed affection for me. She did it with an original poem on Valentine's Day. The verse, as I recall, was, "The river is wide and you can't step it. I love you and you can't help it." Northern readers may take my word for the fact that there is no difficulty rhyming step and help. While our love didn't last, in fact, I think she gave her Valentine to another the next year, the memory is pleasant. When I grew a little older, I began dating Leah Godwin. We went together for about 5 years. Even at that young age, Leah was a woman that you could put on a pedestal. A lot of things have changed in 60 years, some of them for the better. But one of the casualties of time is a sense of reverence that the young man had for a young woman. It didn't, as the feminists say, restrict the woman. At least, that wasn't the intent. We pictured ourselves as the protectors of our ladies. It wasn't until some years later that I found that most of these ladies probably didn't need our protection. But needed or not, this idea helped define our relationship. As men, we were polite. We refrained from the slightest vulgarity in the presence of a lady, and we were careful not to put her into any danger, either to her person or her reputation. At the same time, she responded by acting like a lady. The fact that many of these ladies were smarter than we were, and some were stronger, didn't matter. We each had our job to do. Most of that I learned during the 5 years that I went with Leah Godwin, and I remember it to this day. Leah and I went to the Baptist Young People's Union at the Hayes Barton Baptist Church every Sunday night, and we were at Hugh Morrison High School during the day and together as much as possible the rest of the time. Leah was a beautiful girl then. She grew up to be a beautiful woman and later married a doctor in Smithfield. My own high school years at Hugh Morrison were a pretty accurate predictor of the next 60 or so years, especially in all of the beginnings. For instance, I proved at Morrison, as I was later to prove again at a number of colleges and universities, that I wasn't a scholar. I didn't have a passion for grades or the study habits to get them. I accepted my C's without flinching and found my identity in other things, like music. I played drums in the orchestra and sang in the glee club. I also tried out for every stage production we had, with some success. For instance, I was the Shah in the musical In a Persian Garden. The Shah was a tyrant, a really mean guy, so I belted out my solos with gusto, conviction, and as much mean as I could muster. I don't remember what kind of reviews we got. Parents are very tolerant of student productions, but I do remember that I enjoyed doing it. I'm sure that my drama teacher and glee club director saw something of a natural ham in me. Unfortunately, my math and Latin teachers probably did too, but it worked out. Another beginning that influenced my life was the YMCA. One of my early heroes was George Stockstill, the local YMCA boys' secretary. He worked with the kids, and he was a friend, but not a peer. I could see that he made a difference in some lives. I think he made a difference in mine. In fact, it was probably because of my respect and admiration for George and my perception of the good that he did that I went to George Williams College in Chicago. Since that's where I met Margie, that was a major move in my life. I was a willing worker for George. One job I remember was on Father's Day. I was assigned to go to the Edenton Street Methodist Church and deliver a short Father's Day recitation at the 11 o'clock service. I don't remember it all, but the ending went, "Be more than his dad, be a pal to the lad, be a part of his life every hour of the day." I found out sometime later that that idealistic charge is easier said than done. Then there was the tennis. Since AJ was an avid tennis player and he was raising his children to be avid tennis players, we had a clay court at home. We all became very decent tennis players, good enough to play on our college teams and to defend the claimed world championship of the father and three sons tennis team that AJ formed. We never had to defend our title, though, because we never found another father and three sons to challenge us. By the time I graduated from high school, I had learned a lot. Maybe not enough of it from the classroom. But I had learned how it felt to entertain. I liked that. And I do it in my own small way to this day. I learned about people who help other people, as George Stockstill did, and I still try to do that. And I learned to respect women and to love a woman, a lesson that has been very helpful in getting Margie to live with me for more than 50 years. I've given up tennis for golf, but I still enjoy the competition, as I have all my life. But, like all good things, high school had to come to an end, and I had to get on with trying to learn enough to have a career. AJ had decided that I should be an actuary. After all, the actuaries at Durham Life made over $10,000 a year. Chapter 3. 3 out of 4 ain't bad. It's fairly obvious why AJ wanted me to be an actuary. He had founded and still owned a substantial part of a life insurance company. Life insurance companies had actuaries, and it probably seemed like the life of an actuary would be a nice, safe, responsible way for me to make a living. Fred making a living was a recurring topic of discussion at various points of my life. What is not so obvious is why I would ever want to be an actuary. Actuaries, though they are probably all honorable people, work with numbers. Professionally, they are more interested in dead people, or the ages at which they die, than they are live ones. That did not make a perfect match with my skills, attitudes, or interests. In the first place, mathematics in any form was not my favorite nor my best subject. The thing I did enjoy, and have always enjoyed, is people. Live and lively people. I didn't reject AJ's suggestion out of hand. I actually interviewed some actuaries, and the interviews confirmed what I already thought. I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up, but I knew I didn't want to be an actuary. When I enrolled at North Carolina State College the following fall, I had some vague notion about majoring in business administration, a notion that was quickly dispelled by unfortunate encounters with calculus and analytics. State was the first of four colleges and universities that I attended. In fact, before it was over, I had been enrolled at three of the Big Four, hence the chapter title, and a school in faraway Chicago. For the record, I would like to point out that I did not flunk out of any of them. I didn't set any new scholastic standards either. Looking back, it seems that the colleges I went to and what I professed to study really reflected strong influences on my life rather than any reasoned plan about what I would do with the rest of my life. That may be just as well. Just as no small boy dreams of growing up to be an actuary, few, if any, would dream of growing up to be the fairy tale man. But at each part of my college career, I can put my finger on the influence that put me there. AJ's interest in my having some sort of business background, plus the fact that it was not that far from home, landed me at State. My mother's long-held hope that I would become a minister encouraged me to go to Wake Forest. The influence of George Stockstill of the Raleigh YMCA caused me to consider and attend YMCA College in Chicago, later named George Williams College. And that, for a couple of reasons, was one of the most significant moves of my life. But all of that started at State. Play the game, fight like men, we're behind you, lose or win, State College, keep fighting along. The North Carolina State University that stretches between Hillsborough Street and Western Boulevard today doesn't have a lot in common with the North Carolina State College I went to in 1928. NC State is still largely agriculture and engineering as it was then. However, in 1928, there were fewer than 2,000 students. A lot of the disciplines that the school is noted for today didn't even exist. A number of very good things did exist, and I enjoyed being a part of them. The band, the glee club, the orchestra, the tennis team. I was active in all of those, and I was sufficiently active in the classroom to keep the school happy. On the front page of the April 5, 1928 issue of The Technician, the college's weekly newspaper, there is, along with a story about a straw vote giving Al Smith a plurality, the story of the most successful tour ever made by the glee club and orchestra, noting that the audience was well pleased with the yodeling of Harry Westcott and the songs rendered by a quartet composed of Bob McCracken, Fred Fletcher, Charlie Overman, and Harry Westcott. Like the rest of the students, I bought my books and supplies at Lonnie Ivey's student supply store and hung out at Stathicus's. We followed the progress of President Brooks' new $30,000 mansion and the D.H. Hill Library. Big bands like Hal Kemp's and Kay Kaiser's played the dances and cotillions. Although North Carolina State had almost no women students, Raleigh was blessed with several women's schools which had no men students. One of these schools, undoubtedly familiar with the wiles of State College students, offered a fishbowl for supervised socializing. I even joined a fraternity. Although I missed this particular bit of initiation, a report of the time mentions that one State fraternity would remove a pledge's shirt and tie him to the ground. Then they would sprinkle corn on his chest and turn several roosters loose. Sort of an Eastern North Carolina version of pouring honey on a prisoner and staking him to an anthill. I matriculated at State for 2 years and had a pleasant time, but not a very satisfying one. After 2 years, I decided to look somewhere else for the preparation for my life's work. So I enrolled at Wake Forest. Oh, here's to Wake Forest, a glass of the finest red Rudy Rhinish.
filled up to the brim.
The Fletcher family has a tradition at Wake Forest. My father graduated from there. My Uncle Arthur graduated from there. And, for a time, it looked like I might graduate from there. By the time I got there, my brother Frank was already enrolled. Wake Forest, which was then located in Wake Forest rather than Winston-Salem, was a quiet and beautiful campus. Compared to the thousands at State, it was a small school with a student body of fewer than 500. It was Southern Baptist, and the curriculum there had a strong religious bent. According to the catalog, tuition at Wake Forest that year was $50 per semester, with another $32.50 charged for general fees. The young student could live in a dormitory for $50 or less per semester and eat with local families for $3.75 to $6 per week. A few years later, when my brother Floyd enrolled at Wake Forest, the prices were about the same. He remembers paying Miss Jo $15 a month for three meals a day. From the time I got there, I loved Wake Forest. Within 60 days, I knew everybody on campus. To a degree, my interests at Wake Forest were the same as they had been at State. The October 12, 1929 edition of the Old Golden Black records that I was elected head cheerleader. I was drum major for the band. I was in the orchestra. I was in the glee club. But my brother Frank beat me out of the baritone spot in the quartet. Frank and I were both on the tennis team, and according to the yellowed clippings that I found, we had a good year. The lead on one of the stories is, "The Demon Deacon tennis team from Wake Forest College hung up its third scalp in as many days by defeating the University of Richmond 8-1. In that match, all of us Demon Deacons bested our opponents except for Hal McMillan, who was finally nosed out by Richmond's Airy. However, Hal and I beat Airy and Brown in the doubles. I had already taken Brown in the singles match. I was also active in the Baptist Church and was a regular at the Sunday evening BYPU, which, for the younger Baptists, evolved into BTU, or Baptist Training Union. I took Bible under Dr. James Lynch and became his assistant. I also made an A in his course. Wake Forest was a good school and a good place to be. But I did not share my mother's feeling about my going into the ministry. I did think that there was a way I could help others, as I had seen George Stockstill help me and my friends. George had shown me that competitive sports under supervision and in the right environment were a good medium for developing character and Christian values. The YMCA had been important to me when I was growing up. I decided I would like to continue in it. To do that meant leaving Wake Forest and going to Chicago. Remember when college basketball games and the Southern Conference tournament were played in the old city auditorium, when City Hall was on Fayetteville and Davy Streets, when we could park on Fayetteville Street. Chapter 4, On My Own in Chicago. Fight for Association College, dear old Golden Blue, we love you. For aspiring YMCA secretaries, there was only one place to go, George Williams College in Chicago. As indicated by its earlier name, YMCA College, it was dedicated to training the people who would work with others through the YMCA. It wasn't as difficult as you might expect to convince A.J. that his oldest son should go to still a third college, and this one in the north. The key was that those who went to George Williams also worked, and after supporting me at State and Wake Forest, A.J. was not unhappy to have me out of his pocketbook. In 1931, he gave me $500 for expenses until I could get settled and wished me well. For the next 5 years, I lived in Chicago and made my own way. I worked, studied, and met the girl who became my wife. Strangely, for a person who had never been out of the South, I found nothing very unusual about the people I encountered at George Williams. We were all there for the same purpose, to become YMCA secretaries or social service agency professionals, and the fact that some were black, some were Hindus, and some were Mexican didn't seem all that important. In fact, the first year I was at George Williams, my roommate was Mexican, Alphonse Gaona of Mexico City. I didn't even have a lot of trouble with the Slavic and Polish names. After I had been in Chicago a while, I could rattle off Polish names like a native. The one difficulty I had was with the telephone operators. In those days before dials, you had to tell the operator the number that you wanted, and she connected you. The Chicago operators did not understand Hyde Park 4444. It didn't take long for me to learn to speak enough Yankee to get my phone calls through. The pace and style of life were very different from what I had grown accustomed to at Wake Forest, however. In the first place, I had to work, and in the early days of the Depression, jobs were not that easy to find. My first job was ushering at University of Chicago football games. The UC team had commanded a national interest because of its legendary coach, Alonzo Stagg, and the interest was sustained by a brilliant player named Jay Berwanger, the first Heisman Trophy winner. Everybody enjoyed the games. I enjoyed them more after I bought a heavy overcoat. As I got further into YMCA work, I found other employment opportunities. I managed a boxing team and a swimming team. I used my southern drawl to try to coax lapsed or inactive members back into the YMCA. I cleaned the floors in the apartments. I also found a job selling shoes. In the summer, I worked at the YMCA camp. However, the most vivid camp memory I have is not of working with the kids, but of getting there. The Y had an old Model T truck that was used to haul the equipment up to Camp Storer on the other side of Lake Michigan at the beginning of the season, and one summer I was the designated driver. The fact that you could see the road go by through the holes in the floorboard wasn't too much of a problem. At the speeds the Model T would go, the road didn't go by very fast. The real problem came when the muffler got hot and ignited the grease around it. Twice on the way to camp, we had to stop and put out the fire before we could continue. Another summer, I was hired to be a tutor companion to Sol Goldberg's son. Mr. Goldberg was the chairman of Electrolux, and his family owned a summer home in the Adirondack Mountains. My work that summer was probably the easiest I have ever had, consisting of listening to young Mr. Goldberg practice his violin and joining him in activities. We built a boat, collected rocks, and generally enjoyed the mountains. Another job that I got that didn't really tax my physical powers was as announcer for the South Chicago YMCA Drum and Bugle Corps. For those who don't regularly attend drum and bugle performances, there is not a lot of announcing to do. You simply wait until they finish playing and tell the audience what the next piece will be. The biggest single problem was getting the corps into the Hammond, Indiana radio station. I don't know why Mr. Pinsky, the corps director, chose me as the announcer, but I'm glad he did. It didn't pay much, but it did give me at least the illusion of radio experience when, a few years later, I found myself in radio. Along with all of that, I formed a band called the Gold and Blue Aces to play dances at the school and in the Chicago area. We had a piano, a guitar player who doubled on fiddle, an alto sax, and a tenor sax. I played drums. The going rate for a local pop band in the early 30s was just $4 or $5 per man, but in those days you could buy a lot for $4 or $5. Later, I even tried my hand at promotion. You'll recall that AJ had promoted musical events as far back as Fuquay. I had seen it done, and it seemed like something we could do in Chicago. So we hired a dance hall and booked a popular Chicago musician named Half Pint Jackson for the evening. I say that Mr. Jackson was popular. That was his reputation, but you couldn't prove it by the turnout we had that night. That evening ended my career as a promoter.